The second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota in regards to Lorena White, appellee in this court, versus Jeffrey Brandt, who is in this court, the appellant. For the appellant is Michael Crew, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the State of South Dakota is Mr. David Braun, a special assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Crew, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Crew, and I'm here representing Jeffrey Brandt, the appellant in this civil action. Briefly, this is an appeal from the trial court's denial of Mr. Brandt's motion for relief from judgment pursuant to SDCL 15-6-60B4. That section provides that if a judgment is void, that the party who's the object of the judgment is entitled to relief from that. We believe that the judgment in the case, it was civil action 93-15-88, is a void judgment. And it's a void judgment for the reason that after Mr. Brandt was served with the summons and complaint in this action, he met with representatives of the plaintiff, particularly one of the investigators for the Office of Child Support Enforcement and the legal assistant for the attorney who was representing the department in this action. And on both occasions, he requested blood testing be done to establish whether or not he was the father of the child. I think that those facts are well documented, particularly by a handwritten note that the legal assistant wrote to the employee of the department, directing her to schedule the blood test for this matter.
Now there were two complaints filed, is that?
Yes.
And that was the first one that you're talking about, is that right? Or is
yes.
The second one?
Yeah, that was after the first summons and complaint were served on him.
But at neither one of them did he ever do anything more than make that phone call, is that right?
Pardon me?
In response to either one of those complaints, all he ever did was make that phone call.
Those were personal meetings. But, yes, he said, I want to have blood tests.
They were personal meetings.
Okay. Yes,
came to the office.
He met personally, yes. The one day he personally met with, I believe it was Catherine Emerson, who was an investigator with the Office of Child Support Enforcement. And apparently she arranged for him then to meet the following day with Peg Johnson, who was Mr. Pokola's legal assistant.
Did you find any case that said that kind of contact constituted appearance?
Well, I think that contact clearly demonstrated his intent to defend the action.
Yeah, but does it constitute an appearance sufficient for notice?
Did you find
any cases that were similar to that?
I think that I think what that did was give them clear notice that he intended to defend the action.
Okay, and is that the test?
I believe that is the test. I think I think that it was a test that was initially established in National Surety Corporation versus Shoemaker, and also in Cromer versus Sullivan, as well as a number of other cases. That is a test. The clear expression of an intent to defend the action is an appearance.
Oh, Mr. Crew, help me with this. The way I understand the record, after the second summons and complaint were served, which apparently was because they started the action over again. Is that right?
I don't know. I mean, I can't explain why it was done. They personally served a summons and complaint on him about a year and a half. It was in November of 1994.
They started a new action, essentially.
Well, I wonder about that, because the court file is 1993-1588 was the initial action. The judgment that's entered in this was entered in civil action 1993-1588.
So it's a different court file then?
It's the same court.
So it's the original. So the original, the first complaint and the second complaint are in the same file.
The same court file.
But they asked for different relief. The second complaint, if I recall, asked for different relief.
Pardon me?
Didn't the second complaint ask for some kind of different relief?
The only difference between the two complaints was that on the second complaint, it asked for... I guess I can't tell you the exact number, $380 a month child support. The first complaint, it was at $200-some dollars a month.
And the second one also asked for the birthing expenses and so forth, right?
I would have to tell you my review of those, or my recollection of my review of both complaints, is that the only distinction between them was the amount of requested monthly child support.
When you get to the final judgment, do they add in the amount that took place over the first period of time, the $200-some a month, to the $300-some a month, or did they just start anew with the second action's amount?
The only figure that I have is that there was at the time of, well, not the time of the second one, but at the time that Mr. Brandt pled guilty, well, where the judgment was actually entered, I'm using the wrong language here, but basically it was $49,000 in arrearage.
But you don't know whether that included the amount that was stated under the first complaint or not?
I do not.
Okay. Did it include the expenses that related to the birthing expenses?
I'm not aware of that.
In this DNA test that was done, is there some? I know that the trial court expressed some concern about the validity of that test. What do you have to say about that?
All I can do is tell you what I know about the blood test is that after Mr. Brandt returned to South Dakota and was convicted in federal court for federal failure to pay child support, he contacted our office and spoke with my wife, Karen, wife and partner, Karen, and expressing the desire that he would want to have blood tests done. And she informed him that when this occurred in 2004, that all he had to do was he could arrange it himself. And so they would agree to do it. And so as a result of that, he then apparently convinced the mother to participate. And the only thing I have got that suggests anything about this was that Mr. Brandt actually provided their samples at the Laboratory of Clinical Medicine at the then Sioux Valley Hospital. The report from the DNA testing, which is Identity Genetics located in Brookings, and it states that Mr. Brandt gave his blood samples sometime in March, early March of 2004, and the mother and the child gave their blood samples sometime in the middle of April of 2004. So I guess, you know, there's certainly, I guess at this point I can't say, yes, you know, that's accurate, because it may be, I mean, I guess the only thing that I can see is, first of all, obviously there are pictures that can establish that. The only thing I can say about that is, the only way, if it really was these, that these three people were tested, I'm assuming that the tests established that the mother and the child were related, and that the father was not Mr. Brandt. So it may be another child is substitute. I mean, I guess I'm getting pretty far out in left field here, but I mean, I'm saying that there are a possibility that that the results you got are not accurate.
Why isn't any of this in the record?
Well, it is. It was brought into the record at the trial court. I should say on the hearing for the motion for summary. Excuse me, the motion for relief from judgment. I mean, the DNA test results are in the record.
That show him not to be the father.
Yes.
How did the trial court deal with that? What did the trial court say when you presented this evidence to that he was your client's not the father? Did the trial court respond in any manner
to
the test results?
You mean to the results?
Yes.
I don't believe that she did. I don't recall any response in her memorandum opinion as a letter, in the form of a letter that addressed the counsel. I don't recall that she made any comments as or response to those results. I think she drew her conclusion, as I reviewed it, was that the second summons and complaint was, in fact, a different action. And therefore, since he did not make any response to the second summons and complaint, then he was not entitled to the notice of intent to take default judgment that obviously does not exist.
Did you have a finding of fact and conclusion of law that he was not the father of the child?
No, she did not.
Pardon?
You asked me, did the judge...
Did you have a finding of fact and conclusions of law, a proposed one in there, or an objection to one if that was to the contrary?
We did, we did submit the blood test results as part of our presentation to the trial court.
Didn't her opinion also... wasn't it also supported with the analysis of estoppel and doctrine of laches, in that he had, subsequent to this now default judgment, actually gone in to modify his child support? So he used that judgment, I mean, he actually reacted to that judgment and acknowledged it and requested that his child support be lowered. How do you get around that?
Well, at the time that he went into court to have his child support, there was a judgment there that had not been challenged. No, I mean, there's no basis to challenge it until he received the test results from the blood test. That all preceded it, the blood test.
So how long can we wait on these things? I mean, if he didn't do it right away, and then he didn't do it later when he challenged his child support, and he didn't do it when he pled guilty to not paying child support, how long do we as a court allow him to wait to challenge it? Isn't there some point where you guys say, wait a minute, this is over?
Well, if this was not a void judgment, I would agree that there's certainly a time limit, but a void judgment is of no force in effect.
But why did he admit, when he went into federal court, why did he admit paternity, and then he did it in one other way at a different time? He petitioned for modification of his child support. In his petition, he noted that he was the parent of CB.
Well, he may well have been the father for all he knew. You know, he was a very likely candidate that he was the father.
But you're telling me that there are the results of blood tests in the file, in the record, that show he's not the father?
Yes, that he is not the father of the child that was tested.
Then why did he admit it in his petition?
Because those blood tests, the petition due for the modification?
Yeah.
Because the blood test results had not been obtained at that point.
I think the point is, though, at the very outset, after the first summons and complaint,
yes,
he questioned whether he was the father and spoke with child support about having a blood test. So he had questions about it from the very beginning, correct?
Yes.
And he never pursued it how many years was it between the time that he first asked for a blood test and he finally...
He first asked for a blood test and, his meeting with the legal assistant where they agreed to have the blood testing done was on September 1st, 1993.
And the test was performed when?
The test was performed in, I believe, the blood draws occurred in March and April of 2004.
So why should you get to wait 11 years to pursue this?
Well, I think the first thing I would point out was that until, I guess I have to bring in some facts. Mr. Brandt was contacted by an agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the Sioux Falls office by telephone at his residence in Merida, Mexico, advising him that there was a federal warrant for his arrest on the charge of failure to pay child support. As a result of receiving that phone call, that call occurred in 2001, and he then had a subsequent conversation with the agent. And the agent told him that someone could get back to him, but he was being taken off the case, and another agent would contact him. And as a result, there was basically a delay of about a year and a half before he was ever contacted again. But he did talk with the agree to come back, and he came back with his wife and child from Mexico and came in and. They went into court and entered his guilty plea. I guess if I could make this statement, I think what's the critical issue or factor here, and the thing that if it had been done correctly, this case would not be here, and that was he was never given an notice of the state's intent to take a default judgment after he did make an appearance by requesting blood testing. And I think this court has been consistent when any case where that has happened that they have found the judgment to be void and granted relief from the judgment. And I think this would be the first case in this state if you were to affirm the judgment where a party that did make an appearance in a case and was later defaulted without receiving a written notice of the intent to take default judgment. Like I said, that would, as my review of the cases, is that would be a first.
Would it be more likely to be the law that such a judgment might be voidable, but if a person sits on his duff and does nothing about it for years and years and years, then it becomes an effective judgment? It was voidable, but he didn't take action into his own hands to get it voided.
I guess I'm trying to get my hands around the idea that a void judgment just through the patch of time becomes a voidable judgment. Again, there's no case in this state, and I'm not aware of just the review I've done of other states where a judgment that's void for, and that's obviously a fairly common occurrence. Is that,
well, it isn't void because it's a valid judgment, but there's a question of whether or not someone could have come in and opened it up and asserted that there was an appearance, but they didn't do that, and therefore the judgment does become valid and effective, especially when he comes into court and admits in federal court and then also admits it in a petition for modification that he's the parent. Seems to me that kind of tends to disprove that it was ever a void judgment in the first place.
Well, I think the facts established in this case that he was not provided with that notice required by SDCO 55B1, where it says if a party has made an appearance, that party shall be given written notice of the intent, shall be given at least 3 days written notice at least 3 days prior to taking the default judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Mr. Group. Okay, Mr. Brown, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Honorable South Dakota Supreme Court, thank you for the opportunity to argue this case today. My name is David Braun. I am Special Assistant Attorney General for the State of South Dakota and Senior Legal Counsel for the Division of Child Support within the Department of Social Services. The Department's position in this case is quite simple and straightforward. As Judge Caldwell determined below, because of the protracted factual history involving this case, essentially the doctrines of res judicata, laches, and judicial estoppel bar any type of relief to Mr. Brandt in this matter. And because the protracted factual history is so critical in this court's decision, I just want to briefly summarize it for you so you know where the department is coming from in this particular case. As indicated in the questioning earlier, Mr. Brandt was served not once, but twice with two separate summons and complaints in this matter. The first one was served upon him in August of 1993. The second was served upon him in December of 1994.
Were the two complaints from the same action, though?
There were two complaints, and Justice Kornkamp, I can't answer the question directly why two were served upon him. I can only surmise. But if you review Judge Caldwell's decision below, it indicates that after the first summons and complaint was served upon him, the parties left the state of South Dakota, the mother, child, and Mr. Brandt. At that point in time, the Child Support Division closed its case and informed all parties that it closed its case. But if the case did reopen again in South Dakota, that it would reopen its case against Mr. Brandt.
Do the two complaints have the same file number?
They have the same file number. Yes, they do.
So there was never a dismissal of the first complaint.
That's correct.
Just simply sat there idle, and then another complaint was served after they located him and the mother wanted.
That's correct. Approximately 16 or 17 months later, the second summons complaint was served upon him.
Does this case hinge on the question whether this was a new action or whether it was simply a continuation of the old action?
In my opinion, Justice Konenkamp, it doesn't hinge upon that particular question, because I think no matter which summons and complaint you look at in this particular case, any question by Mr. Brand or any request to vacate this particular judgment cannot be granted because of the passage of time and what's occurred or transpired since the judgment itself was entered. So I don't think it hinges upon that particular issue, no, in my opinion. It's critical for the court to know that after entry of the default judgment, and that would have been in, I believe, February 1995, excuse me, shortly after that, within a month, Mr. Brandt specifically wrote a letter to the Division of Child Support asking questions about that judgment that had been entered against him. And essentially, once the Division of Child Support got that particular letter from Mr. Brandt, essentially, Special Assistant Attorney General Tom Pokola wrote Mr. Brandt at that time in 1995 and told him that a judgment had been entered and what he needed to do at that point in time if he wanted to question the validity of that judgment. And that particular letter of of Special Assistant Attorney General is included in the record in the other action which we brought. I deposed Mr. Brandt, and there's a number of deposition exhibits that are included that this court needs to consider in deciding, you know, what it's going to do with the particular case. It's also critical, that letter that Mr. Brandt wrote. Factually, if you look at page 10 of his particular brief, his initial brief, he says he had no knowledge of the entry of the judgment, therefore cannot do anything about it. His letter written 1 month later, 1 month after the judgment was entered, the Division of Child Support, belies that particular statement. He knew that judgment was in place 1 month later based upon the letter that Special Assistant Attorney General Tom Pokola sent to him in response to his letter questioning the judgment itself. Yet he chose to do nothing, even though Mr. Pokola advised him what he needed to do if the judgment was in place and this is what he needed to do to contest it. He did absolutely nothing.
Is there also a return of service from a sheriff or a constable on the second action?
Yes,
in
there
the
is.
File?
Yes, there is, and that's included within the deposition exhibits that we included in the other action to this action.
Did the judgment include the amount for the first period of time prior to the time he and everybody else moved out of state?
It only includes the amounts that were requested in the second complaint, which was a different amount of child support than the first complaint.
Right. It was a larger amount, but it did that also include the amount that would have accrued during the first series after the summons and complaint?
It would be my understanding, and I haven't computed back that way, but it would be my understanding, or I suspicion and suspect, that what occurred that after the default judgment was entered on the second complaint, they went back to the date of the birth of the child, which would basically trigger the initial child support obligation forward, and use the amount then that was requested for in the second complaint and not the first. I believe that's how the arrearages would have been computed.
I would assume that the notice of entry, judgment, and the Pokola letter were just simply sent by first-class mail.
That's correct. That would be my understanding, Mr. Chief Justice. But it is apparent he received it. It's important that he did receive that judgment, because 1 month later he wrote a letter to the division questioning what he should do, and that response of Special Assistant Attorney General Pokola specifically advised him at that time what he needed to do.
So the letter refers... Or quick draw here. The letter refers back to the judgment that he wrote, so it's, you say, a fair representation he knew about it.
He knew about it. His letter that's in the file shows that he knew, and the response from Assistant Attorney General Pokola specifically advised him what he needed to do now the judgment had been entered. Correct.
Now, if a party makes a legal appearance, conceding that there's a legal appearance, and the opposing side then obtains a default judgment without giving notice of entry, without giving a notice of intent to seek the default judgment, is the judgment voidable or void?
It'd be my estimation, in my opinion, it'd be voidable. And it has to be, if it's not void on its face. In other words, the judgment is in place. And it's our position that it is voidable, but if it's going to be voidable, it has to be done within a reasonable amount of time. Something has to be done within a reasonable amount of time, not 13 or 14 years later, then come in and say, I want to set aside this judgment.
Right, but you're arguing a laches argument there. But if the judgment, the question is there a case in South Dakota that says that even a judgment that's obtained without notice of intent to take that is still a valid judgment? Has there been a case deciding that?
To my knowledge, no.
I mean, because other courts in other states have said, if you obtain a default judgment without giving the 3-day notice, the judgment is void. It could never be. It can never be valid by process of time. It remains void.
I understand that the concern and the issue, Justice Kohnkamp. My response would be twofold. First of all, what this court has to remember is that Mr. Brandt only requested DNA testing informally after service of the first summons and complaint upon him. That's the only request he made, after the first service summons complaint upon him. When the second summons complaint was served upon him approximately 15 or 16 months later, he did nothing.
All right, this goes back to my first question then. As to the question of the void analysis, if we're going to say that this is a void judgment, or that a judgment without the notice of intent to take is a void judgment, then doesn't this case really hinge on whether or not the first or this is a new action when the second complaint is served, or whether this is simply a continuation of the first action with an amended complaint?
I believe it hinges upon when he responded. I don't believe this court can properly, in my estimation, say that a request for DNA testing after service of the first summons and complaint constitutes an appearance, and assuming a request for DNA testing constitutes a legal appearance. I found no cases in this jurisdiction or any others that indicated that.
You're saying that even if there was no second complaint, even if he had just simply gone to the office after the first complaint, asked for the DNA testing, you're saying that's not an appearance?
At that point in time, we would have provided DNA testing voluntarily.
No, but that's not my question. My question is that an appearance? Let's suppose that there was no second complaint.
In my opinion, it's not an appearance, Justice Kohnkamp. No, no. I can find no case law that indicates a request for DNA testing in a case of this nature constitutes an appearance that triggers the statute for the 3-day notice. I can find no case law here or anyplace else that establishes that. The second factor this court has to consider is that even after this passage of time, Mr. Brandt basically ratified and confirmed the validity of this judgment in September 2003.
When ratify a void judgment, though, right? If it's a void judgment, it wouldn't matter if 1,000 years went by.
It depends upon the analysis you take, Justice Kohnkamp, because this court has also said, this court has recognized the legal principle of judicial estoppel. And I cited those cases in my brief. And essentially, judicial estoppel is based upon the premise that a person cannot take a totally inconsistent position with a position they've taken previously. And that's exactly what is occurring in this particular case. In September 2003, Mr. Brandt voluntarily signed a petition under oath that he was the father of this child and asked for reduction of the child support obligation that was contained in the judgment, which he is now challenging. Essentially, Judge Caldwell, who was also the judge in that modification matter, granted that request and reduced his child support from $368 to $320 a month.
Did the trial court say that this was precluded by judicial estoppel?
The court did recognize judicial estoppel, latches, res judicata. Those three legal principles the court did address in this memorandum decision, yes.
And ruled that judicial estoppel precluded.
Well, I'm not sure that was a specific ruling. I know that res judicata, she talked about that, probably primary and most within her decision. She also then within the decision talked about estoppel and latches. I can't recall specifically what she said on the estoppel aspect, Justice Kohnkamp, at this point. The other fact
I want to discuss for a minute, if there's a default judgment and there is a claim that an appearance was made, and then, of course, the claim is made that it's a void judgment, it couldn't possibly be a void judgment until somebody came back into court and not only made an appearance but argued strenuously enough to be successful to get the court to rule that that was, in fact, an appearance and, therefore, the judgment was void, wasn't it?
Yes, and I would fully concur
right
with that analysis.
So up until that time, it's got to be, at most, a voidable judgment. I don't care what other states might have called it. So until a succeeding court ruled that it was a void judgment because there was an appearance, it's an effective judgment.
That would be our position in this particular case, yes. Because the passage of time that occurred and his actions in between that passage of time essentially he confirmed and affirmed the validity of that judgment within the circuit court system of South Dakota. And he cannot walk in now some 13 years later and say, I'm sorry, that judgment is now void because I made an appearance in an action that transpired back in 1993 or 1995.
And he never did obtain a circuit court judge's final ruling that it was a void judgment because there was, in fact, an appearance.
That is correct. The action that he took is he filed a motion to set aside the judgment under 15660B, which Judge Caldwell denied because of those legal principles, and which brings us to the court here today.
And that's the first pleading he files all the way back to.
That's correct.
So if you had looked at that file prior to him filing that motion, there is no answer, there is no special appearance, there is no nothing.
There's absolutely nothing, Chief Justice, up until the time he files a motion to set aside, which brings us to this court today.
When the department sought a default judgment, was there an affidavit attached that said he hadn't appeared?
Yes, I believe there was, and I believe it is in the record. I believe it's part of it is included in Exhibit 1 of his deposition, which I included within this particular record.
There was no mention in that affidavit that they had had contact with him and that he requested a DNA.
I don't believe that is in that affidavit, no.
Isn't there a problem about that?
Justice Meyer, I can't see how there is because, first of all, it goes back to Justice Kohlenkamp's question, does a request for DNA testing constitute an appearance in an action warranting 3 days' notice? It's our position, no.
Wouldn't that be an intent to defend it? I mean, could you interpret that if you say, well, I don't know if I'm the father, I want a DNA testing. Wouldn't that be an intent to defend
it? I think that would show that he has some questions whether or not he's the father. And essentially, if he would have pursued it in a timely manner, we would have accommodated him and these particular issues. We probably would never not be here before this court.
Was there some evidence that he had sent in a check at some time?
Excuse me?
Was there something in the record here that he had sent in a check for the DNA testing at one time?
It appears to me, and again, I wasn't involved at the level below in 1995, but it appears to me in my review of everything that we have within the file, that after the default judgment was entered against him, it appears to me that when he wrote the letter 1 month later to the Division of Child Support requesting or asking questions about the judgment, at that point in time, he sent in $300 for DNA testing. At that stage, then, if you look at Deposition Exhibit 3, the response of Mr. Polkel says, I'm returning your $300 to you because the judgment is now final in place and we cannot do anything about it now. And specifically what Mr. Polkel told him to do, which was the correct thing to do. Nobody's playing unfairly with him. Polkel told him essentially, I'm returning your $300. The judgment is now in place with the court and final. If you want DNA testing, you need to petition the court, now get his permission to get DNA testing done. And also, I highly urge you to get a lawyer from Sioux Falls to represent you to get that done. In other words, nobody was playing unfair with Mr. Brandt. There was no surprises here. Pokola specifically advised him 1 month after the judgment of what he needed to do, and he did nothing. The next thing he did is 8.5 years later, he comes before the court and petitions to modify the exact same judgment where he says under oath, I'm the father of the child, I want my support obligation.
There's kind of the problem is kind of this lacuna because they leave the state and so it has to start again. But if, going back to the first request, when he went in and said, I'd like to have a DNA test, at that point he would have been given one, is that right?
It's my understanding that he would have been given one.
That's the practice. I mean, when I was a circuit judge, I just remember that somebody came in and said, I want a DNA test. We just treated it as normal right. They could have it. I think there's a statute on it, if I recall. If they ask for it, they can have one. Maybe I'm wrong. But it seems to me that we're just looking at the process here. If someone comes in and says, I just got this petition for paternity, I want a DNA test, the office would have just set him up for a DNA test, the mother and him and the child.
At that stage, and even today, within the department itself, if that occurred and there's a timely request for DNA, we would provide DNA because we also want to know who the correct biological father is.
Right, and then if the DNA test comes back showing he's not the father, then the petition is dismissed and that's the end of the case.
As far as that individual is concerned.
So, it's hard for me to accept that a person coming in and saying, okay, I want a DNA test, knowing that if the test comes out his way, the case will be dismissed. Why is that not an appearance showing you're intending to defend the action?
Well, and again, I cannot find any case law that indicates that that constitutes an appearance. And again, Justice Konenkamp, the court also, which Judge Caldwell focused upon below, because of the passage of time. Am I happy that he's now named the father of this particular child when he's not the biological father? No.
Right, but the passage of time hinges on, I mean, that only works if it's a voidable judgment. If it's a void judgment, and as I understand, that's all he's arguing. He's not arguing. He's arguing, his Rule 60 motion was, this judgment is void ab initio because I didn't get my 3 days notice.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, I'm sorry.
The problem with that argument, in my thinking, Justice Konenkamp, is that, number one, I don't know how he can come before a circuit court in this state 8.5 years later after entry of the judgment and under oath basically affirm the validity of the judgment and say, I am the father and I want my support obligation reduced, and essentially the trial court grants that. I don't know then how you come in 5 years again later and say, I'm sorry, I was, you know, it's a void judgment. Essentially, he's taking totally inconsistent positions before the courts of the state of South Dakota, and I'm sorry, our case law and the case law of this court does not allow it.
That's a judicial estoppel argument.
That's where judicial estoppel comes in.
If the trial judge didn't rule on that, can we go ahead and look at the case and say, all right, that's what disposes of the issue?
Well, I believe that she did address estoppel within her memorandum decision, Justice Konenkamp.
Right.
She relied a lot upon res judicata, but I believe within her memorandum decision, which is in the record, she also mentioned laches and estoppel. And so I think that all those factors, and understand that res judicata, as you well know, laches and estoppel, all kind of hinge upon the passage of time. You slept on your rights, and even though you may have had relief coming, because you slept on those rights in the passage of time, you can no longer assert those rights. And I think those are the factors she looked at below in her memorandum decision. And I understand your concern about the appearance, but it wasn't the department's fault that he took no action. The actions he took 8.5 later affirmed the validity of the judgment. The second problem that arises in this particular case is if you void, or if you say that the first judgment was void, my question then is, what about then when he went before the court and got the order modified? In 2003, is that then void too? What about the federal conviction? The federal conviction in federal district court where he walked in and pled guilty to felony non-support in federal district court in Sioux Falls, and the judge basically entered a federal criminal conviction against him and ordered $46,000 in restitution for past
well, there's certainly a prejudice to the state because if the state has to go back and find the person who maybe is the father, there's a 6-year statute on how far they can go back.
So. That's correct. That's going to create a whole set of different issues in this particular case, and I don't know if the case would even be resurrectable because I don't know where we'd even start looking for the correct father at this point in time.
Your time has expired, Mr. Brown. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Crew, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I think I would first like to point out to the court, as far as a out-of-time, as far as something being out of time to make an appearance in this case, and I'm referring to the National Surety Corporation versus Shoemaker case. In that case, the court wrote an extensive decision and covered many different aspects of what amounts to an appearance, what were the consequences of an appearance. In particular, there's a long drawn out litigation going on in three states in that case, and South Dakota apparently was the last state involved. But apparently what happened in that case is that prior to initiating the case in South Dakota, the plaintiff sued Mr. Shoemaker in Michigan. And in that case, Mr. Shoemaker then answered the Michigan complaint. And there's nothing further in the record as to what happened with that Michigan case. But the South Dakota Supreme Court held that Mr. Shoemaker's answer in the Michigan complaint constituted an appearance in the South Dakota action because he notified them that he was denying their claim in the Michigan case. So the South Dakota Supreme Court held that constitutes an appearance. In the present case, I think the record shows that I think particularly the meeting between Mr. Brandt and Peg Johnson, Mr. Pokel's legal assistant, and the note that she wrote too, saying that go ahead and let's get the blood testing done. The reason that the blood testing didn't proceed at that time was that shortly after that time, the mother left the state, and they closed. The case was actually closed about 2 days after he had met with the legal assistant. So they closed the case, and then it remained dormant until they initiated the second summons and complaint in November of the following year.
But there's no appearance whatsoever to the second complaint, is there?
That's correct. No, he did not take any action after that. But I think if you look at the National Surety Corporation case and where the court held, and there are obviously other reasons that they held that he had made an appearance, but they said that his answer in the Michigan case constituted an appearance in the South Dakota case to enable him to obtain an order vacating the default judgment that was entered in that case. So I think in the legal matter, that's the same result as we believe should be the result here. Let's see. I was trying
to think. It might have been if he had come in within a month of the second action and said, that constitutes an appearance, But he didn't. He never got a declaration from anybody that there was an appearance.
Well, I think also in the National Surety Court case, and I think other cases that have done it, and I think I also cited Cromer versus Sullivan, and I think in the brief I list two other cases that have also stated this the same, that an appearance when a party, obviously in this case the defendant, makes a clear showing of his intent to defend against the complaint that's been served on him, that does constitute an appearance. Makes that clear showing to the other party.
Forever, huh?
Well, until all that they had to do in this case was if they had served him the written notice of intent to take default judgment, then we wouldn't be here. They didn't do that. And that, as a result of that, it's a void judgment. And that's my client's position.
Yeah, I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Group. Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.